Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The world is teeming with refugees, 35 million and growing. Some are displaced by terror and the war on terror. More are victims of old ethnic conflicts and new economic, political, and environmental battles. They live in tattered camps, often in squalor and despair. But where should they go? The United States? Back home? Nowhere? In this hour, refugees and America's obligations, personal stories, and public policy. Begin with today's startling news that the federal government has been operating a secret shadow government since 9/11. Bart Gilman broke the story in today's Washington Post. Earlier, I asked him to describe this backup government in the bunker. Where is it? Who's there? And what kind of work are they doing?
Well, you could think of it as a kind of backup copy in miniature of the senior management of government. They're top-level career officials. They're not usually political appointees. And they are preparing to take control of the federal regional offices in case Washington is somehow disabled.
Your story in the Washington Post this morning suggests that only a nuclear attack could achieve the kind of devastation that would require this alternate government. Does that mean that the federal government is still concerned about a nuclear attack?
It sure does. The government has not said that it knows that al-Qaeda has a nuclear weapon, and I don't think it does know that. But it can't rule it out. And once you have that eventuality, one official said, it means game over unless we have an invulnerable cadre of government officials somewhere else.
Bart Gilman, within the last couple of weeks, the New York Times has reported that the U.S. government has said that they don't believe Osama bin Laden had nuclear materials capable of supporting a nuclear weapon. Does the continued existence of this shadow government suggest otherwise?
Well, what the Times actually said was that the U.S. government had not found fissionable materials in Afghanistan. But the government has not concluded from that al-Qaeda doesn't have them. In fact, I think the government believes that al-Qaeda does have some radiological materials. After all, hospital wastes and nuclear energy wastes, such as strontium-90 and cesium, are relatively common, and they've been known to be stolen from lots of places, including the former Soviet Union.
Is Vice President Cheney the figure in charge of this backup government?
Well, whoever survives, who's in the constitutional line of succession, will be the commander-in-chief. The point here is that the commander-in-chief needs someone to command. And so what this shadow operation does is give a kind of unannounced compliment to the fact that Vice President Cheney has been out of Washington during much of the last 5 months.
But let me then put that question another way, because everyone's noticed that absence from Washington. Is the location of the shadow government and Dick Cheney's frequent location the same?
The shadow government is in two places. Cheney has spent some of his time at one of them, and the Washington Post has agreed not to discuss the locations any further.
I was also curious on that front. Did the Washington Post know about this shadow government before yesterday, before today's story came out? Was there also an agreement to hold that information?
I first heard about it, and my colleague Susan Schmidt first heard about it well before yesterday. But it took us time to satisfy ourselves about the truth of it and also to negotiate with the White House about what it considered to be the significant national security issues in a story like this. Eventually, the White House asked us to hold back three particular facts, and we agreed to hold them all back.
Describe bunker duty for us. You said that these are outdated facilities, that the computers can't even interact with government databases now. Does it feel like walking back into the Dr. Strangelove Cold War era?
I'm sure that it feels quite strange for the civilians who are deployed. The U.S. military is used to this kind of underground 24-hour-a-day bunker duty. They've been doing it since the dawn of the nuclear age in places like Cheyenne Mountain and in Colorado. But if you're an Interior Department or Transportation Department official, this is probably not uppermost in your career plans. at one of the two sites, it's true that the computers were several generations old, that there weren't enough phone lines, there weren't enough facilities for secure video links. They're upgrading those.
You've agreed not to talk about the location of these facilities, and I guess all press members have, but I just went to Google and punched in shadow government location, and a lot of information comes up. How secret are these locations, in fact?
There is a kind of large handful of locations that have been discussed over the years as having facilities like this, but we're not going to link this in the Washington Post, this particular deployment, to any particular one of those places.
And Bart Gellman, in this new era of terrorist threat, can this kind of shadow government, this bunker government, ever be disbanded?
Well, that's a great question. I've been trying to imagine what circumstance would enable them to say, okay, it's all clear, you can come home now. Once you say that you can't rule out a nuclear weapon, how do you ever prove that negative, and how do you ever have the confidence that this alarm is over? One official told me that this may just be part of the new reality.
That may make the job of vice president even less appealing.
If such a thing were possible.
Bart Gellman is a reporter for The Washington Post. After September 11th last fall, America closed its borders to refugees for 2 months. A trickle began arriving again in December, and the Senate is now holding hearings to determine new policy and procedures for refugee admissions. But in these volatile times, just how open should and can America's borders still be to refugees? In a world crisscrossed with conflict and displaced people, how should we decide who should be allowed in? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Maryland is Bill Frelick, Director of the United States Committee for Refugees. Good evening and welcome, Bill Frelick.
Hello, pleased to be here.
Good to have you. And with us in the studio is Rita Kantorowski, Regional Director of the International Refugee Committee in Boston. Good evening and welcome, Rita Kantorowski.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Bill Frelick, you have recently testified before the U.S. Senate on the issue of refugees and their flow, or the lack of flow into the United States. And clearly, there's a big ripple of concern going around the world that doors are slamming on refugees at the very moment at which the numbers are bigger than they've been since the height of World War II. What is the concern exactly here? There was a temporary shutdown or suspension of admissions of refugees to the United States right after 9/11 when many things were frozen. Are you concerned that for some reason that's not going to open up again?
Well, I think it's certainly slowed to a trickle, and we certainly are concerned. On the other hand, President Bush has reiterated his commitment to admit refugees to the United States, as has the Commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service and the Director of the Refugee Bureau at the State Department. So we've gotten all the right signals from the right people. Now it's a matter of seeing whether, in fact, they are able to carry through on those commitments.
And yet it seems that there's a big ripple of concern running through here in spite of all that. That Australia has recently made it much more difficult for refugees to come in, even in Europe. Denmark has taken steps in that direction. The United States is only allowing in, 70,000 a year now, down from 200,000 a year in the mid-80s. Is there a global trend to shut the door on refugees, and why?
I think the trend has been there, and it's been there even prior to September 11th, but that certainly did exacerbate the situation. Refugees are a symptom, if you will, of a very disorderly, dangerous world, and they are the victims of those dangers and that disorder, not the causes of it. And I think that is the point that we have seen, and I think that the leadership of our country does understand ultimately. But it's a tough choice when immigration is generally something where the receiving country determines who we want to admit, and we have the sovereign right to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, to recognize that refugee movement is not a voluntary movement. These are people who are forced out of their homes, who have to flee and really have nowhere to go. And so they throw themselves on the mercy of the international community. And it's really fundamentally a human rights question that involves some necessity for the international community to share the burden. And what that usually means is that in the vicinity of the upheavals themselves, the neighboring countries are the ones that really bear the brunt of the burden. And what more distant countries like the United States generally do is to provide funding for refugee camps and to try to support refugees through providing food and medicine and that sort of thing. And for those who cannot remain safely in the countries of what are called first asylum, those neighboring states, or who have no prospects of being able to return or are in some danger, then the United States and other countries would consider resettling those refugees, bringing them here. And that's the program that was suspended immediately after September 11th and is only now beginning to start up again.
Bill Frelick, it seems to me that something about the degree of global instability and the huge size of the numbers, 34 million, 35 million people displaced, makes the kind of numbers that the United States has been admitting, 70,000 a year, seem so puny as to almost be unimportant. Do you know what I mean? When so many are displaced, so what is, but I know you fight for that number. Mm-hmm. What is so important about that 70,000 against a sea of 34, 35 million? Are we in a new age where taking refugees is just kind of a quixotic gesture without meaning, or is there another perspective?
It provides two solutions, basically. For a relatively small number of people, it's a absolute necessary protection for people who are in great danger, who have been individually selected, usually by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, that are in imminent danger. That's a very sort of labor-intensive, hard process of picking those people. But it actually saves real lives of real people who are in imminent danger. The other thing that refugee resettlement does is a little bit harder to understand, perhaps, but particularly when you're talking about the numbers that you just presented. Mm-hmm. And that is that it's used as part of a comprehensive solution. It's used to leverage burden sharing from other countries. It's trying to, in a sense, swing a deal with those neighboring states, the poor states that just by
you take some, we'll take some,
or just to keep their doors open for temporary asylum. Mm-hmm. So that what you're doing is, by admitting a few people, you create a safety valve. Mm-hmm. We saw it most dramatically recently in the crisis in Kosovo, where Macedonia basically said, hey, we're not going to take any more of these ethnic Albanians out of Kosovo unless somebody relieves the pressure. And so the United States really exerted really remarkable leadership and said, okay, we'll take some. We brought them to Fort Dix, and Germany brought some to their country, and other countries began to share the burden as well.
So even a relative spoonful can make a difference.
Exactly. And Macedonia then relented. It opened up its borders. Mm-hmm. You may recall there was a place called the Blache crossing point where people were sitting in the mud and where you didn't...
Yes, we do. It looked awful.
Yeah, it was horrible. And what happened because of the agreement of the international community to share that burden and to tell Macedonia, your country will not be destabilized. We're going to step in and we're going to help you out. I think it's actually a great example. And Macedonia, which has had a really rocky year, it was on the verge of ethnic cleansing and
yet they stepped in and helped. They stepped right in and helped. Bill Frelick, stand by. I want to turn to Rita Kantorowski here for a moment before we go to a break. And we're going to be hearing from refugees tonight in the course of this show as well. But Rita, you deal up close and personal with refugees coming into the New England area in particular. It's not just a question of big numbers like 35 million. These are also human stories one by one. Are they, when you see these refugees showing up, are their needs as acute as they've ever been?
I think the needs of refugees are the same as they always have been. People need a place to live. They need food. They need orientation to where they are. Many of the refugees from some of the more critical areas where people have survived torture or extreme trauma. There are some other issues involved there, and they need additional help, and Congress has provided that money for torture treatment centers around the United States.
We're going to be diving into all this with Rita Kantorowski, Bill Frelick, and with refugees telling their story of life in the United States post 9/11. In a world in turmoil, who is a refugee today? And who of the world's 35 million refugees should come to the United States? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tonight we're talking about the lives of refugees around the world and in the United States, particularly since 9/11. I want to start this segment with a radio diary from an Afghan doctor now living in the United States.
My name is Soraya Hashimi, and when I was at the third year of medical school, my father was killed. It was, conflict between communist government and Mujahideen. Because I was the oldest child, I became responsible for my younger brothers and sisters. And also I had to care about my mother. She was very sick. It was very hard for me to take care of the family and also continue my study. But I finished medical school and became a doctor and started work as a OBGYN doctor. The reason that we left Afghanistan, like as another Afghani people, it was a war situation and also restriction on women issue. It was the Taliban government. They put many restrictions on women. Like women couldn't, do anything outside or work. And the war left lot of women widow. They have to support them, support their family. They need to go out and work. So that's why most of women, they was obligated and they need to move to another country. So I am the one of these women or family that we moved to another country. It's really hard for my mother because she's old. But I'm, in general, for all Afghani who are like old age, it's different to adjust American culture. It's really different because they are coming from different culture. It's hard to adjust, a new culture. Today I checked, it was 180, 110. I asked, her doctor, what should I do by that time? Because the healthcare or system is different from here to back home. We were there like a doctor. We got everything. We know it. The medicine. We did, but here we need to go to the. So I know what should I do, but I have to have the advice first. I have been here now a year, and things have been getting easier and easier. We are slowly starting to feel like we have a home again. Right now, everything is unstable and complex situation in Afghanistan. I can't really, say that I'm going to go back to Afghanistan. But right now, I decided to be here and get my certificate again to be a doctor. So it's my dream. I hope to keep it.
That was Soraya Hashimi, an Afghan doctor now living in Worcester, Massachusetts, and one of the voices of the refugee population that is so large in the world today. In this case, a woman who has come as a refugee to the United States. But there are 35 million refugees around the country. There's been a slowdown in the intake to the U.S. since 9/11. And there's a sound of doors slamming around the world about who should come. We're joined tonight by Bill Frelick, director of the United States Committee for Refugees in Maryland, here in the studio by Rita Kantorowski. She's regional director of the International Refugee Committee. You're welcome to join us as well. What is America's moral obligation to refugees globally today? Does America have an obligation? And which refugees should Washington invite in? Which should stay in camps? And which should just go home? And who should decide? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Rita Kantorowski, you watch this flow of refugees very firsthand, up close and personal. I guess you've seen the number of refugees coming into the United States slow since 9/11. Has it been notable? Can you tell that there's been there was a shutoff and that there is a slowdown?
It's definitely a very dramatic change from our normal fiscal year. The fiscal year begins on October 1st, and by this time in the year, we would probably have resettled close to more than 200 refugees.
That's just in New England or Massachusetts?
Just through the IRC offices in Boston and in Worcester.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that figure is under 30 at this time.
Mm-hmm. Do you sense a change in the attitude of the American population towards refugees since 9/11 or since any point you'd like to point at?
I think in general, the reaction of the American people is very positive mm-hmm. towards refugees. I think that people relate to the United States as being a safe haven, a place for people who are literally dying to be free,
mm-hmm.
and that they support this kind of orderly flow that the U.S. government supports each year to admit people to this country who have no other option except to resettle in a third country.
Mm-hmm. And Bill Frelick, what about the security issue? Has it come into play in American attitudes toward refugees? We know that there was, of course, an enormous roundup of Middle Eastern men. Many of them were held on charges of illegal papers, immigration papers, and so on. Do the security issue and the refugee acceptance issue intersect politically?
That's hard to say because it really hasn't been measured politically. There was a security review that the Justice Department in particular conducted of the refugee program, and after 2 months they were satisfied that they could begin the program up again with a few changes, but essentially not a whole lot different than it had been before. And I think that what that says is that the refugee program has always been very careful to ensure that there's very, very thorough screening of people before they're admitted to this country.
Really, these should be the most scrutinized immigrants.
I think that's fair to say. They go through a referral system from the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. There are non-governmental organizations that are involved both overseas and here in the process. Both the State Department and the Immigration and Naturalization Service is involved. And there are security advisory opinions that are issued by the various security agents, such as the FBI here in the United States for each case that's admitted. On the other hand, there are something like 90,000 foreign visitors that arrive in the United States every day. I mean, those are tourists and business people, students, various forms of non-immigrants. But there's nothing remotely like that level of scrutiny for so many people that do enter the country. And the handful of people that were involved in the terrorist attacks in September were people that arrived on non-immigrant visas.
These were not refugees, and they were not immigrants. The security issue is not really the issue here. Yet we read the New York Times editorial very recently saying Western nations, more and more, are adopting the view that refugees are not victims in need of sanctuary, but a political problem to be solved by keeping them anywhere but here. Why is that attitude growing, Bill Frelick?
Well, it's an easy way out, basically. And I think that certainly any of us could subscribe to the idea that you want to address the root causes of refugee flows. You want to address the human rights violations and peacemaking and war and this sort of thing. But the willingness of the international community to really tackle the causes of refugee flows is really quite an undertaking. And even to provide humanitarian relief, we see scale backs that are occurring there as well in country after country. The European Union has really not come through in the way that it should and has the capability of doing. And so I think this is a particularly critical moment for the United States, which itself was bore the attack of September 11th, to be able to stand up and say that this is not a security threat, that refugees are the victims of these kinds of evils. And, when you look at the axis of evil, we have refugees fleeing from North Korea into China, of all places. We have refugees fleeing from Iran. We have them fleeing from Iraq. And to understand that these are people who we ought to be sympathetic to and not view as the enemy.
Rita Kantorowski, Most refugees have sponsors in the United States when they come, don't they? Are they assigned sponsors? Is that still the case? I remember during the period of Vietnamese boat people, I was in Southeast Asia a lot when they were flooding up in the tens and hundreds of thousands, and most of them had sponsors. Is that still the case?
Well, I think we want to make sure that we don't confuse sponsorship as it relates to U.S. immigration and people arriving on immigrant visas.
Oh, what is the term then? Are they still assigned a kind of a partner family in the United States to help them get settled?
Right. Many have friends and relatives in the United States that they're coming to join who, quote unquote, sponsor them.
I see.
And help them, along with the resettlement agencies like the International Rescue Committee.
But do we still have the pattern that we saw with the Vietnamese boat people of American families volunteering to host and help get started refugee families from abroad, or was that a historical phenomenon that passed?
I think we see it again and again in refugee crises. We saw it with the Kosovars, for example. We saw it with the Kurds in northern Iraq. We saw it with the so-called Lost Boys of Sudan, where the American people have opened their arms to refugees who have come in groups, and many of these special groups come in a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work with the public. We have a number of Sudanese refugees now that are living in a community in Lincoln, and the whole community
mm-hmm.
has adopted them.
Mm-hmm. We're joined now by Ria Kulinovic, a Bosnian refugee, and now a program director with the International Refugee Committee. Ria, when did you come to the United States, and under what circumstances?
I came to the United States in August 1995 as a refugee.
How old were you then?
20.
Did you come with your family?
No, I came here by myself.
And you lost your family, or how did you come to the United States at that age by yourself?
No, I was fortunate enough to have my family still alive, living in Sarajevo. I was pretty wildlife living in Sarajevo 3 years under the siege and occupation, so my family decided to let me go.
And how did you get into the limited intake of refugees that the United States takes? How were you, I don't know if the word is lucky enough, or just how did it happen that you were one of those chosen to be identified as a candidate to be a refugee and to be brought to the U.S.?
When I left Sarajevo, I went to Croatia, and since Bosnia and Croatia were in a war at that time in 1995, I was considered as an enemy in Croatia, so I seek protection at the UNHCR, and mm-hmm. that's how I learned about the United States Resettlement Program.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, I was interviewed twice by the immigration officer, and I was eligible for the program.
Of course, we all remember the horrible images in Sarajevo of the sharpshooters taking people down in the streets, and we know of all the shelling and the suffering that went on there. What has being a refugee to the United States meant for you? What did it mean for your family? What's been the importance of it?
First year, it's been very hard. It was hard for my family to adjust that I'm not living with them, that I'm really far from them, and it's not that easy to come and see me very often.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess we all adjusted. It was reality for us. We had to accept it.
Let me put it in a different way. Do you plan to move back to Bosnia at some point?
No.
Or, why not? I mean, what exactly, you know, Bosnia is peaceful now. You're healthy and young. The United States gave you shelter when the trauma was severe. I guess Americans may look out at the millions of refugees and say, well, gee, we can't take everybody in here. Why wouldn't you go back to Bosnia? And I don't mean it in an unwelcoming way. It's a honest question.
Yeah, my perspective really changed. If you asked me that question my first year mm-hmm. when I was in the United States, I would love to go back home because mm-hmm. it was really hard for me. But the time passed, and I guess became more American. I really mm-hmm. adjusted well here.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that must be a pattern that's gone on through decades.
Yes, mm-hmm. and I guess a lot of refugees feel the same way. I guess the first year is the hardest, but then you adjust, and you become American in a way. So,
listeners, in the post-Cold War, post-9/11 world, which suffering displaced people should have first claim on American Sanctuary? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Bruce is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, Bruce. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Hi.
You've been focusing so far on the population of refugees who are essentially in the care of one government or another and who are, in some cases, eligible for a resettlement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's worth pointing out that there are thousands of refugees who come to the U.S. who aren't waiting to be resettled, who aren't waiting for a government to take care of them, who get here on their own to claim asylum. And when they come here and they show up at a U.S. port of entry without the appropriate visa to get in, we lock them up. A year ago, I was living in New York City, and I took part in a church-sponsored program visiting some of these detained asylum seekers. And I was just horrified at the conditions. They're basically treated like prisoners. They live in these private-run detention centers that are contracted out by the INS to different corrections corporations. Mm-hmm. And when I would speak with some of the detainees, you can't actually make physical contact with them. They cannot make contact with a visitor from the outside. You go and you speak through a phone and you look at them through a plate of glass.
Bruce, does this offend your sense of how America should be positioned toward asylum seekers?
Well, one of your guests just spoke of people, Americans, envisioning our country as a safe haven. And if that's the case, I think we really need to look at this practice. Surely a lot of the people who come and claim asylum are doing so under false pretenses, and that's the whole reason for this program.
Mm-hmm.
But many of them aren't, and I think treating this entire population, there are thousands of these people in detention right now,
mm-hmm.
and some of them will stay in detention for up to 2 years waiting for their cases to go before judges. And I think, it offended my sensibilities as an American, thinking of my country as a safe haven when we're treating some of the most vulnerable people who arrive here, you know, the mm-hmm. tired, wretched masses yearning to breathe free.
Right.
We're locking them up and treating them, in some cases, worse than criminals.
Bruce, thanks for sharing what you've seen. Rita Kantorowski, is there a difference between asylum seekers and refugees who come through your program? Do you deal with people who actually get to the States on their own out of desperation or for whatever reason seeking asylum? Do they come through your pipeline as well?
Asylees apply for political asylum in the United States. There's two different parts of the immigration law, one that deals with refugees who get their refugee status outside the United States mm-hmm. and asylees who apply within the United States.
And have you seen what Bruce is talking about?
Yes, people absolutely.
Essentially imprisoned for a year, 2 years?
Right. The adjudications at the airport are not without mistakes. By INS officers. Sometimes those INS officers are not trained correctly. In 2001, there were 64,700 asylum applications filed in the United States.
Does it mean all those were filed in the U.S. itself, on U.S.
soil? That's right. That's right.
So those are people who showed up at ports or probably airports saying, help me.
Right. And there is an incredible backlog of cases for asylum as well. And asylees don't receive any kind of resettlement services. They mm-hmm. wait sometimes a very long time to receive resettlement. Within the last year or so, we are able to help them once they receive asylum with some of the same services that refugees receive, and we're very happy to do that in the Boston and Worcester offices of the IRC.
What portion of that 65,000 who came were actually found to be legitimate asylum seekers? Do you have any idea?
I don't know, but I think that the number is relatively small.
Mm-hmm.
And many of those people are people who have severe trauma, who literally had to get on a plane and to get out of their country.
Mm-hmm.
And many have been torture survivors.
We're talking about the United States, the world, and refugees. Can the world's problems be solved by flying people to new homes? And if they can't, should we do it anyway? Should we do it just because it's the right thing? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This hour, we're talking about refugees and their lives around the world and in America during these uncertain times.
My name is Nadia Katana. I'm 18 years old, and I came from Congo, Kinshasa. I left my country because of the war. Every time they were killing people, because I look Rwandese, the Congolese will try to kill me. Even in the street, you can just see, if they see like black people that were skinny and have the same face, they just kill them without asking, where are you from, or what do you do, why are you here? We had to leave the country because they came to arrest us, and my dad was in prison for 14 days, I was in prison for 2 days. And after that, we went back home, and they were, like, coming every day at home and try to kill us, put the gun in the face and beat us, and we had to leave the country. If we stayed, we will be dead. America was the first country that accepted us. I've been here for 1 year and now 2 months and 5 days. Here, I'm going to school. I'm kind of like it. My dad's working, but he doesn't really like it, because in my country he was a pilot, but here he's a cashier. My mother also have a problem, like, to try to speak in English, and she's doing the work that she never did it before. So we are not really comfortable with everything. Some of what I miss in my country are my friends, families, and maybe the food. I'm not sure if I can go back. Maybe after 10 or 12 years, maybe, but I'm not sure. If there was an opportunity to for me to go back in my country, I will go back. But not to stay over there for my life, but just to go and just to go for the vacation and come back here, because I'm not really sure about my country, African countries, and everything is not really stable. You are not sure what will happen next, but America, you are comfortable and you don't have to care about the future. But in my country, you are like scared if maybe tomorrow you're gonna be dead or not. I hope to go to the university, and after that I can start my new job, and I want to be a pilot as quickly as possible and start my life.
That was Nadia Cantana. An 18-year-old Congolese refugee, she's a senior at South High Community School in Worcester, Massachusetts. We're talking about a world full of refugees and American policy toward them tonight. Immediately after 9/11, the United States suspended the intake of refugees for several months, and it's barely begun to come back to its previous levels. There are questions about who is a refugee today, about the level of overall intake. President Bush is committed to taking 70,000 refugees a year right now. That number was over 200,000 in the 1980s. In a world with 35 million refugees, what should the U.S. policy on taking them in be? And if you were homeless, stateless, and in danger, would you expect some nation to take you in? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Nancy is on the line. Welcome, Nancy. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, just asked, would you expect some nation to take me in if I was homeless? That was a great question, and I think I would expect, I would want the country to take me in who had caused it. And I'm talking now about Iraq. When I went to Iraq, I met, in 1997, I met families and children there, and I was so sad to realize that I couldn't bring any of them back with me to the United States, that the United States does not accept refugees from Iraq. At least that's my understanding of policy.
Why did you want to bring them back, Nancy?
Oh, because they had nothing left. They had no medical care. They had nothing to grow up to become. I met a little boy once, and I asked him, you know, with an interpreter, what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he said he wanted to be a refugee.
But, Nancy, in a world with so much turmoil, Iraq must have 10, 20 million children. How many can the United States take? How big a difference would it make if the United States took refugees from Iraq? It's a country of millions of people.
Yes, 22 million. About 10 million are children.
Mm-hmm.
My point was that since we're causing the chaos in Iraq with our sanctions, we should be allowing people who are trying to flee to come to the United States. We had some friends who fled to Turkey, you know, fled in the night to Turkey, and they couldn't get to the United States. After a year and a half of hiding out in Turkey, we were able to help them get to Canada, but it was a very slow, painful, and expensive process.
It's a very interesting perspective, Nancy. Thanks for your call, especially now when the United States is reaching out aggressively into the world with the war on terror to achieve security for the U.S., but of course, that can have consequences. Bill Frelick, in Maryland, there's been a lot of conversation about where the priorities should be, who should be among the 70,000 that come in a year, and a lot of the priority systems that the U.S. uses are still in place from Cold War years. For example, I think Jews from the former Soviet Union are still one of the largest groups admitted, though probably not among those in most dire need today. Is it time for a recalculation of priorities about who should be permitted to come to the U.S.?
Yeah, I think that it's long overdue, and I think it's part one of the problems. Certainly has been that the State Department has approached this in a very bureaucratic way.
What should the new priorities be?
Well, certainly the first priority should be, and technically is, people who are in imminent danger, the people that I mentioned at the outset of this show. Who,
that's calculated by physical danger, or they're going to be snuffed out politically? Or
It's people who are, first, they are refugees, and of course any priority would be a person who's a refugee, but usually these are people who are in an additional danger in their countries of asylum, and where they're at risk of being forced back into the country of persecution, or in fact someone's coming after them there. The second priority, currently there's a second priority, which are some of the category groups that you talked about, that many of which date back from the Cold War. And the third priority currently is family reunification cases, and these are immediate family members. And then there are fourth and fifth priorities that are actually not even used, which are for more distant relatives. And that's basically the system as it exists today.
And what about Afghan refugees, for example, to Nancy's question? When we help create a situation, do we have a special responsibility? Are Afghans being given refugee status in the U.S. now, or being told, go back to Afghanistan and rebuild the country?
There have been some admissions of some Afghans, and in particular what are called women at risk. These are women who are widows in Pakistan for the most part. And the IRC, the folks that are also on the line here, have a very interesting project in Pakistan where they're actually trying to help to identify some of those women at risk for U.S. resettlement. And that's been one of the few bright lights of a very creative program that I'm very pleased to see.
We'll try and hear more about that after a short break. We're going to hear more from refugees right now. Mohammed Al-Fatlah left his home in Iraq 11 years ago and spent 2 years in a refugee camp in Saudi Arabia before settling in the Boston area. Here, Mohammed talks about what being an American means to him.
My name is Mohammed Al-Fatlawi. I'm originally from Iraq, and I'm here as a refugee. I've been here since 1993. It's all because of what's happened after the Gulf War has ended and there was an uprising against the government of Saddam Hussein, and I was a part of it. There was no way for us to stay there, because had we stayed, he would execute us, so we had to leave the country. After the uprising has failed, people of Iraq had to go south to the area that was protected by the American army, and then we were taken by the American army and put in a refugees camp in Saudi Arabia. And I believe there was about 50,000 people in that camp back then. Most of us have left the camp to different countries in the world. Now, I came to America. Some people went to Sweden or Norway or anywhere. And there are still about 5,500 people in that camp. I was in the camp for exactly 2 years and 2 months. Definitely didn't like it there. It was in the middle of the desert. We only had tents. We were really isolated from the outside world for a long period of time. We did not even have radios. We did not get any newspapers. We did not know what was happening in our own country. We were basically imprisoned. We were not treated nicely. We were not getting enough food. We were not getting any like human treatment. I was very happy when I got here. I was excited. I thought my life is finally starting to be peaceful. I'm away from all this war mess. I'm no longer like being afraid of being killed or being chased by my government. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anybody. I met this lady from the International Rescue Committee, And she has referred me some schools, English schools. And in that school, I learned a little bit of English, and I learned the best way to find a job. And I started the job, and I've been working since then. It was a big change, just be an American. As they say, be what you want to be here, as long as you don't bother anybody. My family is still in Iraq, and I haven't seen them for 11 years. I call them on the phone sometimes, but it's kind of restricted. There's a lot of things that I can't say. For example, if I say, how are you doing, they have to say, yes, I'm doing okay. They really can't tell me the truth. After September 11, I think it was the most dramatic change in my life. Before September 11, I used to think, here I am in a peaceful country. I'm not going to be bothered anymore. And after September 11, I felt victimized. Like sometimes, because I look Arabic, so sometimes a lot of people just come to me and say, hey, do you know Osama bin Laden? And I find that very offensive. I don't know him. I don't like him. They shouldn't be asking me. You know, why ask me? I'm an American. I live in America. I pay taxes, and I have nothing to do with all this terrorist thing that's happening. I, along with about 18 million Iraqis, were the ones that fought side by side with the American against the government of Saddam Hussein. And we both had this one goal of making Iraq a peaceful country by removing its regime. Now, I know for sure that every Iraqi person wants Saddam Hussein out of there. Nobody likes him. But we're just afraid what's going to happen after he's gone. When I first came to this country, it was like a dream happening. I was really very happy to see everything here. People, the smile on faces of the people, the buildings, the nature, the beautiful nature of the country. I loved everything, and I still love it here. Definitely every day I feel like I'm proven. Went to school, I graduated from school, and I just hope that I'm living a peaceful life away from all this mess that's happening in the world. I wish that I am heard. People would listen to us when we talk. I definitely do want to become a citizen. I just want to be in a country where I think I belong to it, right? I'm not isolated from any of the process in that country. I'm treated like any other citizen.
That was Muhammad Al-Fatlawi, an Iraqi refugee living in the Boston area since 1993. Rita Kantorowski, our time is running down. Your last thoughts on what Americans need to know about the refugee problem globally and in the U.S.?
I think I would leave you with the thought that the refugee program is no different than it ever has been since the 1930s and 40s, when refugees first started coming to this country as victims of the Holocaust and escaping the Holocaust, that although some things are different in our society, it's probably a lot more complex right now, and perhaps the political situations are more complex, that people that come here, you've heard from the radio diaries, that people come here, they love this country. They gain their citizenship and become functioning members of our society, just as my grandparents did and many other Americans' families did.
Rita Kantorowski, Regional Director for the International Refugee Committee, thanks for being with us tonight.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Ria Kulinovich, you're a refugee yourself, and now you're pretty much American. What's your message to Americans about the importance of being open to refugees?
Refugees usually contribute to our economy as well. They enrich our cultural vibrancy. Refugees also are more grateful for the opportunity to live in this country and cherish the values of democracy and freedom, more because they know what is it like to live without them. And I think we should continue bringing the refugees to the United States.
Ria Kulinovich is a Bosnian refugee and program director of the International Refugee Committee. We're also joined tonight by Bill Frelich, director of the United States Committee for Refugees. Bill, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Ria, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That's Refugees. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.